We're looking at John 9 and 10 under the title, A Contrast of Shepherds. And I said last week that John 9 and 10 are a literary unit in the Gospel of John. They're meant to be read together, both chapters 9 and 10. And in both of these, it's a contrast of shepherds because the central idea is Jesus' claim to be the good shepherd in contrast to the wicked shepherds of Israel, namely, in this context, the high priests and those religious rulers who served under them. They are what I'm calling the wicked shepherds. I don't believe that in chapter 9 or 10, we actually have that designation of them. But the prophecy we looked at last week in Ezekiel 34 certainly says this of the wicked rulers. And all of the negative aspects of their rule certainly shows them to be the kind of people that Ezekiel prophesied in Ezekiel 34. And so for our purposes, I'm drawing the contrast with that terminology from the Old Testament. In John 9, the story of Jesus healing the man born blind is one in which we see the actions of Jesus, the good shepherd, healing and then seeking out this lost sheep, this man born blind, while the wicked shepherds, you remember, revile the man and cast him out. Then in John 10, as we will see, Jesus explains this contrast between himself and the wicked shepherds theologically. So in chapter 9, we have the actions of both of these shepherds, and we can see them in contrast. And then in chapter 10, we have the explanation of their actions, and we see that in contrast. Israel's political leaders have always been thought of as shepherds. Psalm 78, 70, and 71 says, God chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds. From following the nursing ewes, he brought him to shepherd Jacob, his people, Israel, his inheritance. The kings and even God himself in the Old Testament was often depicted as a shepherd. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture, Psalm 100. And in Ezekiel 34, which we read last week, Ezekiel prophesies judgment against the wicked shepherds of Israel because they did not care for the sheep, but rather fleeced the sheep. They failed to protect the sheep. They treated the sheep according to their own interests. And they failed to be the shepherds for God, for God's people. So God said in Ezekiel 34, one day I myself will come and rescue the sheep and seek them and gather them and care for them. And what we see in John 9 and 10 is the evidence of this very thing Ezekiel proclaimed. We see the wicked shepherds and their abuse, and we see the good shepherd, the Son of God himself, rescuing the sheep, chapter 9. Then, so that we can't miss the significance of chapter 9, we have the explicit teaching of Jesus in chapter 10 of what Jesus is doing when he heals this blind man. Now, I mentioned this last week, but this morning I wanted to give you some extra background concerning the priests and how they came to be the rulers or the shepherds of Israel during the time of Christ. And I think this will help you understand the background a little better to John 9 and 10, but it'll also give you an appreciation for the role of the priests in the New Testament whenever you see them mentioned, especially in the Gospels, but also afterwards in the epistles. Going back about 300 to 400 years before Christ, most of us know that Alexander the Great conquered the known world and that his empire upon his sudden and his sudden death after his brief life. His empire was divided between his generals. And for about a decade or so after that, there was this fighting all over the known world. And, we think of four generals in particular who won the territory, but there were about 8, 9, or 10 of them when it started out, all vying for position and land holdings and that sort of thing. And Ptolemy, one of his generals, took the land holdings, Egypt, and you see how the red goes up into Israel. That's what initially happened. And Seleucus took all of this over to the right-hand side of the screen, but in particular, for our purposes, he took Syria, which is right north of Israel. And Israel already had a long-standing history of fighting against Syria anyway. Damascus, as you see up there, is the capital of Syria. And Ptolemy took the name Ptolemy the First and started a dynasty in Egypt. And Seleucus took the name Seleucus the First and started a dynasty in Syria. And there was a lot of fighting for about 30 years after that between them, and control of Jerusalem went back and forth between various generals. I always think of Jerusalem as sort of this basketball during this time period and all the way into the Roman Empire, just being tossed back and forth between superpowers. In fact, starting with Assyria coming down and taking Israel, it sort of became that way. They were always surrounded, and their political, their ability to govern themselves was always very tenuous. But Jerusalem went back and forth between various generals. But by 301 BC, Egypt under Ptolemy was securely under Egyptian control and stayed under the Ptolemies for about 100 years. And the Jews enjoyed relative independence during this time. The Ptolemies didn't really bother them too much. But in 200 BC, Jerusalem fell under Syrian control. So the Seleucid dynasty takes over, and they always wanted Israel anyway, because they always wanted more. I mean, you see that big swath of green? They had all that. I mean, why couldn't they be satisfied? But they wanted Israel, too. They wanted to be probably the world dominators. Rome came along and destroyed that for them later on, of course. But they took over Israel during that time. And the Seleucid dynasty took more of an interest in Israel, particularly because they were trying to make Israel adopt Greek customs. And that was the reason for much unrest that followed in coming years. I'm just giving you the highlights here of the history. In 175 BC, Antiochus IV comes to the throne. He is the Seleucids' most notorious king, historically speaking. He's actually a type of the Antichrist in the Bible. So you know that's a pretty bad king. And in the political fallout and bloodshed and the corruption that followed, Antiochus put the office of high priest up to the highest bidder. And it kept going back and forth between a couple of men around this time who were trying to take over the office of the priesthood. And this action moved the priesthood out of the spiritual realm and distinctly into the political realm, you see. And this may be where we can mark the beginning of the decline of the Jewish priesthood. And when Antiochus tried to force Hellenization on the Jews, he tried to force them to become Greek. He even turned the temple of the Lord into a temple to Zeus. And let me know this history. It's really an amazing history. When you think of the 400-year period between Malachi, the end of the Old Testament, and when Christ comes, the beginning, you know there's like a 400-year period. We call it a period of silence. Let me tell you, there's nothing silent going on during this. If you start reading that history, you realize there's this colorful array of amazing things that are happening, and even God continuing to protect his people during that time. And Antiochus tries to turn the temple of God into a temple of Zeus. He even sacrifices a swine on the altar. And it sparks a revolt, which was led by the Maccabean family. And so when the Maccabean family rose up and led Israel against the Syrians, the brothers of the Maccabean family came to power. And they began to assume for themselves the office of high priest. Now, they were Levites. It was okay for them to do that. But they ousted the other priests in order to be able to do this. Judas Maccabees, which most of us know by name, he's the only one, if we know anything about this story, by name. He didn't take the office of high priest, but he died in battle, and his brother Jonathan took over. He took the office of high priest. And in fact, his first act of being the high priest was to reside over the Feast of Tabernacles in 153 BC. That year. And remember, the Feast of Tabernacles is the Jewish feast that is in the context of John 9 and most of John 10, as we talked about a little bit last week. It started in John 7, and we're still in that same context in John 7, 8, 9, and 10. And so Jonathan took the office of high priest, and if I don't know how familiar you are with, I know some of you are very familiar with the whole Essene community. They settled in what we know as Qumran, and this is where the shepherd boy was throwing rocks into the caves, and he heard something break, and he went and investigated and found these jars full of old ancient scrolls and didn't know what it was and brought them home, and they were the Isaiah scrolls that we have today, and all these writings that were preserved for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years since the first century. This community They have a document, several of them actually, but one in particular, which explains where their community came from, and it tells things about their history. And most scholars believe that it was when Jonathan took the high priesthood, they were the purists who said, this is wrong. This is against what God says in his word. You can't just oust the high priest and then set up your own. And they left and formed their own community, and they were waiting for the return of the Lord because they thought they were the pure Jews who were going to remain faithful until the very end. And so they copied the scriptures and lived in their own little community outside of Jerusalem, way off into the wilderness. So this was not a good thing necessarily. It was more of a political move than a spiritual move. Well, Jonathan dies treacherously, and Simon takes the high priesthood, and he actually takes the title prince. Now, he doesn't take the name king because the kings he knows have to be from the tribe of Judah. He takes the name prince instead because he's a ruler as well as a high priest. Well, his son, John Hyrcanus, comes along, and he's even more of a priest slash ruler. But there was always unrest among the people because they recognized that the priest and the king could not hold the same office. There's only one person, by the way, who rightfully ever did that in human history, right? Jesus Christ is our king and high priest. He's the first one to marry those offices. But that's a whole other wonderful rabbit trail that we won't get on this morning. But before John Hyrcanus dies, he tries unsuccessfully to move those offices apart again. He has a son named Judas, and he makes Judas the high priest, and he asks his wife to continue to hold the political reins while he died. Well, Judas didn't like that arrangement, and he threw his mother into prison where she starved to death. And after that, he assumed both roles very eagerly. And so the role of priest and king from that point on, with one brief exception when Salome, the only other woman who ever ruled Israel besides Athaliah in the Old Testament, was on the throne. And she, of course, couldn't be high priest, so one of her sons was. Except for that brief period of time, the priesthood and the kingship went together. And it caused a lot of unrest. Remember, it was a political thing. And so it ended up actually with John Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II fighting it out in Jerusalem for who was going to be the king and the priest. And it got so bad, and both of these men appealed to Rome for help. And of course, Rome has been growing in the east and ready to take over the world. So Pompey comes in 63 BC and takes control to stop the fighting. One thing we know about Rome, they don't want unrest in the kingdom. And so he comes in and stops the fighting. And from then on, Israel is ruled by Rome. Rome is their king from then on. And they are allowed the high priesthood to remain intact with Israel. So John Hyrcanus ended up being the high priest, but to be king belonged to Rome. And after that, the Jews were under Roman control. And it was under Roman control that the census was ordered when Mary was great with child. And under Roman control when Jesus was born and lived and paid taxes and was executed by Roman crucifixion. And under Roman control that the news of his death for sins and his resurrection went out into the world. It was Rome who ruled at that point. So after Roman control, the office of priesthood continued to be a very political position. And Rome ruled the people in general and installed civil authority, the Herods and so forth. Really interesting history there, but I won't even get it. I have to read notes when I talk about the history because it's so complicated with different kingdoms marrying into each other and all this. But the high priests ruled the Jewish people according to their tradition, under the Mosaic law. In the time of Jesus, therefore, the priests were effectively the shepherds or rulers of God's people on the local level. And they were politically invested. This is important, which means that their position stood much on popularity and control. And they were rich. They were rich like kings. And their riches came at the expense of money given to them by the poor of Israel, just like Ezekiel was prophesying. Jesus hints at their wealth and position in Luke 20, 46 through 47. You know this verse. Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and love greetings in the marketplaces and the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at feasts, who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. Beginning in the 1970s, archaeologists digging on Mount Zion, in fact, this particular dig was actually given permission for UNC Charlotte. They have an archaeological team, and they're the ones that did the main work initially, at least on this dig, I found out. And what you're seeing here is a first century priest's home in Jerusalem out on Mount Zion. And the scholars who are the archaeologists who were involved in this dig said this is probably the home of one of Jesus' arch enemies. This may have been Caiaphas or Annas or one of the high priests who actually gave the plot for his execution. And what they found here was just a lavish dwelling, which was obviously a priest dwelling for many reasons. They know what they're looking at, these archaeologists. Spacious houses here they had, impressive mosaics on the floors, elaborate dining areas with carved wall decorations, luxuriant interior furnishings. And in our modern vocabulary, we would say they lived in a mansion, these priests slash rulers. And when Jesus arrives then, making claims to be the Son of God, speaking with such grace and authority, and even defending his violation of their religious traditions, their position and popularity were threatened, and they wanted to destroy him. And you get that when you read the Gospels. They were threatened. And that is why this series of teachings where Jesus declares himself to be the good shepherd as opposed to the wicked shepherds, the current leaders of the people, it is so devastating for them what he says, especially in chapter 10, and it helped lead up to his execution. Remember, they just tried to stone him in the temple, and he finds the man born blind and actually puts mud on his eyes and does extra things, as I pointed out last week, which shows he's working on the Sabbath, just pushing them along. This most likely, by the way, happens right before his execution. This is the fall. And then later on in chapter 10, we'll see it becomes the winter. And then that next spring is when he's finally executed. He's pushing them along toward his death and execution, just like he did when, right in the week of his passion, when he goes in and clears the temple and sets himself up as an authority. They have no other choice but to make a move for his execution. So Jesus is saying, don't follow those other shepherds. Follow me. I'm the good shepherd. And when we left John 9 last week, Jesus had healed the man born blind. And in this sign, we noticed the wisdom of the shepherd. The disciples, influenced by the rabbis, assumed that someone had sinned because he was blind. And the good shepherd told them, no, some trials like this one are meant to manifest the glory of God. Then we noted the compassion of the shepherd, and he healed his blindness. And then we noted the healing of the sheep as he came from the pool of Siloam, seeing, and it was barely believable to anyone. So there's this frenzy of activity as people are saying, is this the guy? Is this the one who was born blind? How can he be? And so I want you to pick up in John 9 with the reading in verse 8, and now we'll move forward, get as far as we can this morning. In verse 8 of chapter 9, it says, the neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar, a blind beggar, were saying, is this not the man who used to sit and beg? Some said, it is he. Others said, no, but it is like him. He kept saying, I am the man. So they said to him, how then were your eyes open? He said, the man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and received my sight. They said to him, well, where is he? He said, I do not know. And what you notice here is there's disbelief among the people that this miracle actually occurred. So when the man keeps insisting that his story is true, they take the matter to the Pharisees. And here is where we begin the second major unit of thought in chapter 9. Jesus, the good shepherd, has dealt with the man. Now the Pharisees, who will show themselves to be the wicked shepherds when all is said and done, have an opportunity to deal with the man. And this is how they deal with the man. They don't care for the sheep. They castigate the sheep. In verse 13, it says, they brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. And it's unclear a little bit to me why they bring him to the Pharisees. If you were healed from leprosy, you had to be taken to the temple so that they could declare you to be clean. Not so with blindness. And I don't think they're doing this to get him in trouble. I think they may have been wanting to tell these priests who had been doubting Jesus, look, this is what he did. He healed a man who was born blind. Doesn't this mean he's from God? Doesn't this mean he's for real? In their excitement and haste, they take him to the last people the man needed to see at that moment, the priests. And they were likely looking for affirmation from their shepherds, their religious leaders. And that would have been natural. But then in verse 14, John writes, now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud, notice the work involved, and opened his eyes. You could put parentheses around this statement. He inserts it right here. Now, why does John wait until now to give us this information? Because it is the first time in the story when this information has become relevant. The Sabbath violation was the point of contention, remember, in John 9 when he heals the lame man. And the fact that Jesus healed on the Sabbath will add to this whole context now of the conversation. So now the Pharisees are in a position where they are challenged to affirm or deny this miracle, where to affirm the miracle would be in Jesus' favor and show evidence that he was from God. So the Pharisees go into a session of interrogation of the witnesses, and they deliberate among themselves. And I've broken up this entire section into three interrogations, okay? So here's interrogation number one. The Pharisees question the man. They question the man who was born blind. So start reading in verse 15. So the Pharisees asked him how he had received his sight. He said to them, he put mud on my eyes, I washed, and I see. Truth, by the way, as we saw Wednesday night, is often very simplistic. It's one of the ways we recognize it as the truth. And he can tell the whole story in just a couple of words, notice. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. But others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And there was a division among them. So they said again to the blind man, what do you say about him since he opened your eyes? He said, he is a prophet. Now, I want to summarize their argument like I did last week with deductive syllogisms. So here's the major premise of group one in the temple complex. Premise, God does not listen to sinners. They conclude that from reading the Old Testament and from the tradition. God does not listen to sinners. And then here's the minor premise. Jesus sinned by violating the Sabbath. Therefore, God does not listen to Jesus. And we can go through a whole other series of deductions to get to this point, but it's pretty obvious to us. Therefore, Jesus cannot be from God. But then the other people said, wait a minute, whoever performs signs is from God. We know that also from the Old Testament. And Jesus healed a man who was born blind. And here he is. And they say this is the guy. Conclusion. They don't draw the conclusion. They won't. They won't say it. They'll have it said to them in a moment, but they won't draw the conclusion. And the result here is that the Pharisees are divided. It says there was a division among them. And so being inconclusive, they ask the blind man his opinion. The blind man said he's a prophet. And at this point, remember, he hasn't seen Jesus. And the man's understanding is such that this may be the highest position he knows to attribute to Jesus. He's a prophet. Probably a very respectful term. Remember the woman at the well, and Jesus said to her a lot of things that she had done and basically astounded her with her life story, having never met Jesus. And she said, sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. She said that with awe in her voice, perhaps. That's what the man is saying here. He's not belittling Jesus. He's reaching for one of the highest terms he knows to try to explain who Jesus is. So the man attributes Jesus this position. And they turn then, because of his attitude, to the next set of interrogation, and that is the man's parents. So look at verse 18. The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and received his sight. They just didn't believe his story. You're coming here, you already could see. Jesus didn't heal you, they wouldn't believe him. So they called his parents, the man who had received his sight, and asked him, is this your son, who you say was born blind? How then does he now see? His parents answered, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind. But how he now sees, we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him, he is of age, he will speak for himself. And the question was asked last week, why wouldn't his parents stay up for him? And we would do that for our parents. Well, John gives us the reason, probably anticipating this question. His parents said these things because they feared the Jews, these Jewish rulers, these wicked shepherds. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be the Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, he is of age, ask him. Their answer was, don't ask, don't tell. That was their policy, and it was because they didn't want to be to lose their privilege of being in the synagogue community, which in Jerusalem would be a huge thing if you were ostracized from that community. And so the result here is inconclusive. And so they turn to the man again. And here's interrogation number three. They ask the blind man again. So, verse 24, for the second time, they called the man who had been born blind and said to him, give glory to God, which is a way of saying, tell the truth, be honest with us. We know this man is a sinner. In other words, tell the truth. We know you're lying to us because he's a sinner. The man answered, whether he is a sinner, I do not know. He is looking at this thing truthfully and intensely logically. Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. They said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? He answered them, I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples? And they reviled him, saying, you are his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from. The man answered, why, this is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. I mean, they've already established that, right? But if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Looking at both sets of Pharisees and religious leaders, he's playing to both sides of the crowd here. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. They answered him, you were born in utter sin, and would you teach us? And they cast him out. And the result here is the Pharisees are rebuked, and the man is excommunicated. Now, here's what's going on in the mind of the man. Here is the proper syllogism that's happening in this man who is a beggar. He's born blind, so he's uneducated. He's sitting there begging. He's not been trained. He probably didn't get the same level of parochial training as Jewish boys would have had. He would have been called a foolish and ignorant person. He probably wouldn't even been able to stand up and give testimony in court. But just because he met Jesus and had his eyes open, he knows more than any of them standing there. And so his major premise is God does not listen to sinners. And the corollary to that is God listens to those who worship him and do his will. And the Pharisees have already basically established that for him. The minor premise, Jesus healed a man born blind. And what's the evidence of that? The evidence is I was blind and now I see. There's no other explanation. Therefore, Jesus must be from God. And the Pharisees' opinion about this man is the same as the disciples' initial opinion. He sinned or his parents. That is why he is born blind. That's why he says, you were born in utter sin. And should you be lecturing us? But now they are in utter perplexity. How do they explain that this man who is blind now sees? Their frustration and hardness is palpable. In John's writing, refusing to believe the evidence of the sign right in front of their face, they simply revile him and cast him out. So now he's excommunicated. He has no tabernacle fellowship. He's a man without a home, without a spiritual home. It would be like getting discipline out of your church, only that's the only church. You know, today when people, when churches actually do practice church discipline and people are lovingly, we trust, set outside of the community and prayed for so that they can be loved back into the community, a lot of times the attitude is, fine, I'll just go down the road, or I'll switch denominations or something. We don't understand the accountability aspect of the body much anymore. you can simply go to another church. But there's nothing you can do as a Jew when you're excommunicated from your own synagogue. And so this became the best day of his life and the worst day of his life all at once. He could finally see, but he would be ostracized from Jewish society. And Jesus hears about this. And so what does he do? He goes and seeks him out. Jesus goes with the intent to find this man. And that's why we have, finally, the good shepherd seeking his sheep. And we see a contrast at the end of this chapter between those in the fold with the good shepherd and those outside the fold. And we're going to see that explicit again in chapter 10, those in and those out. And the key to being in or out is belief, and that's it. If you believe or receive the good shepherd or whether you don't, whether you reject him. And those in the fold, as we will see, are those who have spiritual light. And that's one of John's main metaphors that he introduces in the prologue in John 1, which follows all the way through the gospel. And so those are in the fold have spiritual sight, they have light, they have life, they have forgiveness. You see them worshiping. So look at verse 35. Jesus heard that they had cast him out. And having found him, seeking his sheep, it's the same word, it's a very common word for seeking or finding, but it's the same kind of word that's used of Jesus in other parables where he goes seeking for the sheep and finds him. He said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe him?" Remember, he hasn't actually laid eyes on Jesus yet. Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you." He said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. And I want you to note his growing knowledge of Jesus throughout the chapter. First of all, he calls him the man called Jesus in verse 11. What? How did you receive your sight? Well, the man called Jesus healed me. Then later in the chapter, in verse 17, he answers the Pharisees, he's a prophet. Then in verse 27, he says, "Do you want to be his disciples?" He's showing him that his ideas of Jesus are developing. Now he's one whom disciples may follow. And then he says he is from God in verse 33. And now he calls him Lord and worships him. And we see this progression in his understanding of Jesus. And one of the most beautiful pictures in all the gospel is that of the good shepherd seeking this poor sheep. And after Jesus finds the man abused and rejected by the wicked shepherds and thrust out of the temple, we see him worshiping at the feet of his own shepherd. When he woke up that morning, he had virtually nothing. Now he has everything. And you compare that to the men who are outside the fold, who are standing nearby, because Jesus says in verse 39, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things. Okay, so there's probably a crowd that's gathered. Are we also blind? Are you talking about us? Isn't it the only time in the Gospels where they perceive Jesus is talking about them? Sometimes the writer's a little sarcastic about it too. The Pharisees nearby perceived that Jesus was probably talking about them. Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, 'We see,' your guilt remains." And I think we understand his twist of ideas there. Those who understand their spiritual blindness, like Jesus said in the Beatitudes, those who are poor in spirit, those who recognize their spiritual poverty, those are the ones who are going to inherit the kingdom of heaven. Those who recognize their blindness can be healed because they cry out for forgiveness. But those who say, "We don't need healing, we already can see," therefore, they have no forgiveness. Their guilt remains. And in the next chapter, Jesus will begin to make this divide between those who are in the fold and those who are outside the fold explicit as he begins to teach us all that it means for him to be our shepherd. And just to reiterate, and I don't want to repeat this too much, but I don't want you to miss this whole idea of the fact that John has Jesus at the festivals. The synoptic writers do not. They have him going to the temple one time. He's aiming to the temple his whole ministry, and he finally gets to the temple, his Passion Week. And in John, he's got Jesus in and out of Jerusalem. He's got several festivals mentioned. Because when John writes, the temple has been destroyed, and sending shockwaves into the Jewish world. How are we going to survive? How are we going to obey God? How are we going to follow him? How are we going to be faithful? We don't have the temple complex anymore. Half the laws have to do with the temple system. John says, you don't need a temple when you have Jesus Christ. And we have the man excommunicated from the synagogue and worshiping at the feet of Jesus. This is as clear a picture as it can be of John's intention here, of what he's trying to say. And without any break in thought, without any transitions, because John doesn't know his chapters are going to be, or his writing is going to be divided in between chapter 9 and 10. Without any transitions, so that we can assume the same audience is there when Jesus healed the blind man, and the same audience who asks, are we also blind? They're standing there. Jesus begins to teach the crowd with reference to the healing and the seeking of the sheep what just happened. And so now we transition into chapter 10. I want you to keep the scene in mind. We're not, just because it says chapter 10 doesn't mean we go on to a whole other event. The crowd is there, the man is worshiping at the feet of Jesus, and Jesus begins to say things about what is going on right here. And you have to keep that in mind when you start reading chapter 10. But because we're sort of at a natural break here, because we're going from chapter 9 to 10, are there any questions or comments or anything at this point? We're sort of relaxed here. Go ahead, Brother Gary.
I noticed in the ESV versus other translations in 36, they use the word, ESV use the word sir, and others use the word Lord, and ESV translates sir equal to the word Lord. I don't know how they come up with that. I just don't.
You're talking about when he says, who is he, sir? Oh, well, are you talking about where he says, who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?
Yeah. They use the word sir in ESV, and others, they use the word Lord. And ESV claims that it's the equivalent word.
Well, actually, you know, he doesn't know that he's speaking to Christ yet.
I understand.
But is it kurios, which is the word for Lord, both times? I'd be interested to know that. I don't know. I don't have my Greek New Testament with me. Somebody have a Greek New Testament here? They can look that up. Mark, where's your Greek New Testament? Oh, you got it on your phone. Okay, yeah. Find out if he uses kurios for both, okay? It'd be interesting. That's a good question, okay? Translation question, okay? Something else. Don.
I've always been mildly bothered a little by the fact that I thought the parents might be getting a bit of a bum rap in this thing. In the, what's become of this thing of this man who is of age being responsible for his own sins, not for his father's sins, and his father, not, you know, it goes both ways.
Right.
I always thought that was a pretty solid Jewish position, but totally overlooked here.
You mean the fact that every man answers for his own sin?
Yes.
Yeah, and we looked at some of those scriptures last week that the disciples, for some reason, don't have that in mind. And I pointed this out very briefly, but I think it's evidence of the fact that the teaching and traditions of the rabbis, at least what they knew at that time, were so overwhelming in the minds of the people that they ruled over that even the disciples would sometimes make these offhanded observations and come to the wrong conclusion because they're not following their own Old Testament. So I think that's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead, Jonathan.
One really neat connection is, as I've studied Isaiah in chapter 42. The Lord makes a prophecy of his servant, this Messiah that's coming, and commissioning him. He says, I, the Lord, have called thee in righteousness, will hold thy hand, and keep thee, give thee for a covenant of the people, for a light of the Gentiles. And he says, to open the blind eyes. Mm-hmm. And that's his commission of this servant, this Messiah. Yeah. And so the Lord, I think you said last week, there's maybe six instances in the Gospels.
I count six, some will say five, but I think there's a clear difference between two of the stories, even though they're very similar. I think there's at least six accounts. Six accounts where we have an actual story of Jesus healing blindness, and that's in addition to many references where he healed lame and blind and all kinds of people at the same time. Yeah.
Him showing that is like, wow, here he is doing this physical miracle, and the man says since the beginning of the world, nobody's opened the blind eyes. It's like,
and remember Jesus announcing his public ministry, going into the synagogue of his hometown and finding the Isaiah scroll where it says, the Lord has anointed me too. And one of the things he says is, open the eyes of the blind. So this is a dramatic and clear idea. And the signs seem to be getting more intense. And this is the sixth, and there's one more. The last one is Lazarus being raised from the dead. And that is the most dramatic way you could point to the death and resurrection of Christ. But this is pretty close as well. He's turned water to wine, you know. That's pretty good. And he has the whole temple clearing, which is a little more intense. But then you start healing people from a distance, healing the lame, feeding people with no food, healing the blind. And so John is ratcheting up the ideas here, moving toward this climactic sign of Lazarus being raised from the dead. Yeah, one more. Yeah.
I have a question. One thing I've tried to figure out a long time is where through chapter 7 to chapter 10 does it switch from the Feast of Tabernacles to the Feast of Dedication? Is it just at verse 25?
Are you talking about in chapter 10 that we're going to get to?
Yes.
Yeah, we will. I'll point that out in a few minutes. But the first part of chapter 10 probably takes place in October or November. In verse 25, we finally have a switch. And the reason that this event, which happens in winter, I'll point this out to you in a second, is because the theme is the same. John's bringing another shepherd discourse to marry it here to this one, again to explain what's happening, you know, with the good and wicked shepherd. So we'll point that out in a second, but that's a good observation. Yeah, you need to see that so that you can see the progression of thought. And the dedication is probably, well, I'll ask you what you think it is in a minute. Mark.
It is the Greek word kurios.
Okay.
So there's probably a reason they translated it that way, because at that point he was not recognizing.
Okay. That's probably what it is, Gary. Both of them are kurios. So Lord is a good translation for both of those. But the thing is, Lord is such an elastic word. You could use it very commonly just to say, yes, sir. Or you could mean something very particular by it. And probably what the ESV translators are trying to do is show the difference in the context of both of those. Because why would he say, who is he, Lord, meaning the same thing when he doesn't know who Jesus is? It would sort of be a contradiction. So I think that's why they're trying to do that there.
But then in 38, just two verses later, he does use the word Lord.
So right, because Jesus says, I'm he, I'm the one. Oh, Lord. Lord, I didn't mean Lord, I meant Lord. You know, I mean, that's probably what is going on there, and so they're trying to convey that somehow. But kurios is just the normal word Lord. And even Jesus says that. When he's talking to the disciples and says, you know, the Gentiles have lords, in other words, people over them. Well, he's not using the word Lord there, like himself as the Lord. When the Lord is used of Jesus in particular, it's very close to Yahweh or Jehovah in the Old Testament. And in fact, when you're reading quotations of the Old Testament, where in the Old Testament it is used as Yahweh or Jehovah, you know, Yahweh and Jehovah are the same word, it's just a different pronunciation of the same Hebrew word. When it's quoting the Old Testament using Yahweh, it uses kurios in the New Testament. And so it's only by the context that you can tell whether it's Lord or just a regular Lord. So, but that's a good point to make. Yeah.
And just for the record, it is translated as sir several other times when they were talking to Jesus.
Okay, same. So the same word is translated sir.
Even in the King James.
In the King James,
so,
too. Okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah. It's when they're not recognizing at that very moment that he is the Messiah.
There's a lot of words like that, too, in our own language. You know, the word love doesn't always mean the same thing every time you say it, you know. And so this is the kind of thing that's happening there. Good discussion here. We got textual questions, content questions, anything else? All right, let's move forward then into chapter 10. And again, keeping this scene in front of us of the man there who is kneeling next to Jesus, and news has traveled. Jesus healed this blind man, and now he's cast out of the temple. I imagine people are starting to crowd around. I mean, Jesus is talking to somebody when he's saying all these things. People are crowding around, and they see Jesus and this man who was born blind, and they look through the crowd, and they can see this poor sheep who has been brought into the fold, kneeling before Jesus in worship. And Jesus looks around and he sees the crowd and it's full of believers and unbelievers, citizens and rulers of Israel alike. And Jesus opens his mouth and says to them, verse 1, "Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs in by another way, that man is a thief and a robber." I wonder who he's referring to there in the crowd. And by the way, there is no place in John where Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you," which begins a brand new discourse. This is obviously the way John, we can tell by the way the rest of the way John writes the gospel, a continuation of what's happened in chapter 9. Just wanted to point that out. This is a sure thing. Then Jesus says, "But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep." I wonder who he's pointing to when he says that. "To him the gatekeeper opens the sheep." And I just see him motioning to the man who's kneeling in worship. "The sheep hear his voice. And he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. A stranger they will not follow, but they will flee from him, for they do not know the voice of strangers." Now, I want to show you, because we're not going to get through this, obviously. We'll finish this next week. I just want to take this first few couple of verses. I want to show you where we're going here in chapter 10. We're going to look at two main divisions here, and they're actually divisions that are marked historically, because when it says it is winter, he starts going into a whole other discourse. But the good shepherd and the wicked shepherds are the subject here in verses 1 through 21. And remember why I'm using the terminology wicked shepherds. And we're going to see a contrast here between the true shepherd and the stranger, who's also called murderers or robbers and thieves, by the way, but he uses the word stranger here. And there he's going to draw a contrast between himself as the door and the thieves, and himself as the good shepherd and the hired hand, somebody who's paid to watch the sheep. And after the first one, A there, and then B and C, you have different public reactions to what he says. Then there's a whole other thing that happens, a whole other discourse that happens 2 months later, probably, that John puts in here, where he's talking about the good shepherd and the sheep and those who don't believe. In the second half, those who either follow the shepherd or reject the shepherd come into view. So we see the good shepherd and the sheep. Now look down at verse 22, and I'll draw attention to what we were talking about a second ago. John jumps to another public discourse, and he says, "At that time," verse 22, "the feast of dedication took place at Jerusalem, and it was winter." What feast do you think this is, by the way? What?
Hanukkah?
Yeah, it's Hanukkah, the Feast of Lights, which, ironically, celebrates the rededication of the temple after Antiochus Epiphanes, back to our history lesson at the beginning, desecrated the temple, and then Judas Maccabeus rose up and led the Israelites against Syria. After the first couple of years of bitter fighting, they finally took Jerusalem back and took the temple back and rededicated the temple. And the oil and the lamp, the oil supply, because of all the fighting and the war-ravaged territory, they didn't have enough oil, they believed, to light the lamps for 8 days, which is what the law said had to happen for the purification of the temple. And so they lit the lamps anyway, and by some miracle, the story goes, the lamps stay lit, and they dedicated the temple with a little bit of oil, and the lamps stayed lit for 8 days. And so Jesus is here again for this feast. It's not an Old Testament feast, which is ironic. It's a feast that was established during that 400-year period, and yet Jesus is on hand. And John joins these two occasions because in both of them, Jesus uses the metaphor of himself as a shepherd. In the second half, a hostile crowd of Jews sees Jesus walking through the temple in an enclosed area, by the way, because it's winter and it's probably colder, and they surround him, and they demand to know this: what are you really saying about yourself? Who are you really? Tell us once and for all. And Jesus says, "You know, I've told you, and the reason you don't believe is you're not my sheep. My sheep hear my voice, and they know me, and they follow me, and I give unto them eternal life. And they shall never perish," etc. That's what brings up that discussion. But because Jesus is referring to himself again as a shepherd, John puts this in the same context. So let's unpack for a moment what Jesus says in these first five verses, and then we'll wrap up for this morning. Notice in verse 1 that he begins by commenting on those who are not the good shepherd, those who are trying to get at the sheep, who are not their true shepherd. They have another motive in mind. He calls them thieves and robbers. And in verse 5, the last verse of this first section, he refers to the wicked shepherds again, this time using the metaphor of a stranger. And in the context, it's probably a stranger who was like the wicked, the ones that had the wicked intent. But in the middle, he draws the contrast with the good shepherd. And notice what he says about him. Verse 2, "But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep." In those days, sheep were kept in many places. I know if you think of out west and different pictures you have in your mind of sheep being kept in pens and that kind of thing, we do it a certain way here. But in Israel, even today, in the Middle East, even today, they do it the same way that they did back then. And oftentimes, sheep were kept in the courtyard of the villa or the household. And there was a wall, often a stone wall, and there was often a gate. And it was where the family lived, where they would keep the sheep outside and then walk them out every morning to go into the pasture. And so notice the contrast between how the men in the illustration enter the sheepfold. In verse 2, Jesus says, "He who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep." Verse 3, "To him the gatekeeper opens." You see, the gate in this section is the symbol of authority. Often when you go into a store, you see those signs. They used to scare me when I was a kid. Employees only. I didn't know what an employee was. I thought that was something really, really important, you know. No visitors beyond this point. Have you seen that before? And I was always wondering what mysterious things go on behind that door. But in my college years, I worked for a drugstore for a while, and we had a door in the back of the store that said employees only. And I had a name tag, which had the company name on it, and I was able to walk through that door, and there was just a bathroom and a drinking fountain and a little dank storage room. There wasn't really anything there, and my dreams as a child were crushed at that point because I thought there would be something really nice behind that door. But a door is authority. Even your front door of your house, you don't expect people to just walk right in because it's not their house. You have the authority to walk in because you own it. And so those who are not true shepherds will not have the gate open to them. They have to find another way in. So in verse 1, Jesus says they climb up another way. They find another way to get at the sheep because they have no true authority over the sheep. And if they have no authority over the sheep and they are still trying to get at the sheep, then they do not have the sheep's best interest in mind. They're there to steal the sheep or harm the sheep in some way, like we saw in John 9. Notice again there are verses 3 and 4. "To him the gatekeeper opens. The sheep hears his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. A stranger they will not follow, but they will flee from him, for they do not know the voice of strangers." And notice the progression here. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them. They follow him, for they know his voice, in contrast to the stranger in verse 5, from which they flee, for they do not know his voice. The true shepherd's authority is shown in the fact that he can go through the door. But the shepherd's authority is also shown by the fact that no one follows him except for his sheep. Keeping sheep, as I said, is much the same over in the Middle East today as it is as it was back in Palestine in ancient days. And one author said that after visiting Palestine, he saw that the shepherds would call to their flock from time to time to remind them of his presence. And he said that one shepherd stood at some distance and would call out, and the sheep's ears would go up, and they would come running for the shepherd. In fact, he said there were two shepherds, and there was a storm or something, and so they both had to put their sheep into this cave when they mixed all their sheep together. And he was thinking, well, how are they going to tell the sheep apart the next day? They must be pretty good. But the next morning, they went out, and one of the shepherds went up to a hill and called a particular call, and all of his sheep came running, he said, because they knew the voice of their shepherd. Do you know what unites us together as the body of Christ? Do you know why we're going to observe the Lord's table and we're all going to gather around as his people? Why do we do that? It's because we know together the voice of the true shepherd. And we yield to his call. We listen to him. Notice the reaction of the onlookers, though, in verse 6. This figure of speech Jesus used with them, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. And later in the chapter, Jesus is going to make it plain to them why they don't understand him or listen to him. Because they don't know his voice. And so the implication for us here and the challenge to us is, are we listening to our shepherd? Do we know his voice? Does he really have authority in our life? Are we saying yes to him? Do we come running when he calls? And if you're a believer in Christ this morning, it's because you recognize a time in your life where you needed forgiveness from God, and you grabbed hold of your good shepherd who gave his life for you and rose again. And now you are his, and your whole life is learning the grace of listening to his voice so that he can lead you where he wants. The Lord is my shepherd. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture. And as we continue to read through here in John 10, I know it's fun to beat up on Pharisees and high priests. And say, aha, see where they got it wrong. And we feel a sense of empowerment, I think, when we read stories like this. But the message is also for us. Do we know the shepherd? And is there the evidence in our lives that we know the shepherd? Because we are listening to the shepherd's call. And we'll wrap up there for this morning. Thank you for your good attention. Let's close with our prayer, and then we'll continue on toward our morning worship time. Father, thank you so much for the fact that you give us this living, vibrant, convicting, challenging word. It is alive and rich for today. It's not some dry, dusty gospel. It's full of life. And I pray that you would use it in our lives in that way. And I pray that we would come to know you, like John speaks of knowing the shepherd here in this text. And may we listen to the words of Jesus as we continue to read in John chapter 10, and be challenged to know our shepherd like we never have before, and to follow him like we never have before. And I pray that you would work in our lives richly as we give ourselves to that purpose, because we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.